Okay, here's your mission. In your most convincing voice, ask for $700 billion, like you really need it.
Thank you for calling My Cash Now. To ensure customer satisfaction, this call may be monitored or recorded.
Thank you for calling MCN. This is Gail. How can I help you?
Hi, Gail. Good morning. This is John Hockenberry on The Takeaway, and I need a loan.
Okay. Can I have your home zip code?
Well, can we just cut to the chase? I need $700 billion by Thursday. Can you handle that?
No, sir.
But this is really an emergency. $700 billion?
No, sir.
But the entire world economy depends on you giving me $700 billion. Couldn't we just do the application, $700 billion?
No, sir.
Why?
Because we don't loan out that much.
How much could I get? $600 billion?
No.
$200 billion?
No.
$1 billion? I guess it's less than a billion, huh? So where should I go to get $700 billion if I need it by Thursday?
I'm not sure, sir. Do you have anything else I can help you with today?
Well, no.
Thank you for calling.
All right. Ooh, if Treasury Secretary Paulson can do it, why not any American taxpayer? All hour, give us your pitch at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Do you have the guts to ask for $700 billion by Thursday? Hope Gail isn't on the other end of the line. The whole world is listening. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 23rd, and we're going to be hearing that pitch from Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, who will be on Capitol Hill today, John.
That's correct. Good morning, Adora.
And today we're also going to get more perspectives on the $700 billion bailout that Congress is hammering out for Wall Street. Also, as the markets struggle, nonprofits are bracing for a major shortfall in giving this season. And antsy voters and political parties are taking on incumbents all over the world. We start with Prime Minister Gordon Brown in Britain. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
As Adora said, Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke are on Capitol Hill today to defend the proposed $700 billion bailout plan. In Congress, they're mulling their options, but markets overseas appear to be more calm today than yesterday. Oil's just above $106 in Asian trading down. Dow futures and the S&P futures expect a Wall Street flat open this morning. The U.N. General Assembly gets underway in New York. World economic crisis expected to overshadow the proceedings, and President Bush will be giving his final address at the U.N.
New data finds more than 7.5 million people are spending at least half their incomes on housing. The 2007 figure from the Census Bureau shows a slight increase from the previous year.
In Afghanistan, the Red Cross says some prisoners held by U.S. military at Bagram Air Base will be allowed family visits for the first time today. And why do you deserve a bailout? Let's help Bob out.
Hey, buddy. Have you got a trillion and change to spare? I got back home a hungry CEO and shareholders to feed.
All hour. Give us your best pitch for $700 billion. Hey, if Hank Paulson can do it, why can't you?
Or Bob said a trillion.
A trillion. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. It doesn't matter the amount because we don't have it.
We want to hear your pitch, though. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're very serious about this pitch. We want you to say with a straight face, I need $700 billion by Thursday. 877-8-MY-TAKE is how you can deliver your pitch to us, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. You know, in the United States, we make a lot of hay out of our governmental institutions, particularly on Capitol Hill, the House and the Senate. But it happens to be the case that world markets are poised, watching with great detail exactly what is going on Capitol Hill as Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson attempts to convince Democrats and Republicans that $700 billion from the U.S. Treasury needs to be spent to back up the financial markets all over the world. And it raises an issue that is actually very succinctly stated in the main headline at the Financial Times, the FT today, fears emerge over U.S. bailout. And joining us from the FT is Chris Brown-Humes, who's a market editor for the Financial Times, joining us from London. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Not at all. Good morning.
As world markets are poised, literally looking at what the details are that are being hammered out on Capitol Hill, what are the fears that market makers are really concerned about, and what are they looking for in, say, Bernanke's testimony today and Paulson's testimony today?
Well, I think they're looking for a lot more certainty than they've had at the moment. I mean, we've got this headline figure of $700 billion, but we've still got no idea really how this bailout fund is going to be structured. We don't know precisely what the eligible assets are going to be, what the institutions involved are going to be, how the auctions are going to work to buy these assets. So there's a lot of detail that we simply don't have yet. I think markets are also looking beyond that, though. They want to know that there's going to be political consensus behind whatever package is finally agreed. And, of course, the thing behind even that is, even when we get the package, is it going to work?
So you're looking for efficacy, you're looking for speed, and you're looking for a political consensus. Are you sure you might have this country mistaken for another country?
It may be a tall order, but it's very interesting to see how the, when we heard the details of the 700 first come out last Thursday and Friday, markets were euphoric. I have to say a lot of that has dissipated since then. I mean, as I speak to you now, the main index in the UK at the moment is down 2.5%.
Wow.
So it shows that we're, there's still an awful lot of uncertainty out there.
What's the clock ticking here? I mean, is there a window where beyond which markets are simply going to make their own decisions?
Well, to a certain extent, there is. I mean, of course, the markets are always impatient for news, and they want it now. The trouble is that things as complex as this take a long time to work through. So, there's not a sort of, this has got to be agreed by Thursday lunchtime, or we're going to sell the market again. I mean, it's not like that.
But does that then, to interrupt you, so does that then create its own inherent distrust of the process itself?
Well, I don't think it creates a distrust of the process itself. Markets have got to understand that things as complex as this take an awful long time to work through, and it's better to get a properly thought through package than one that has to be revised repeatedly on the way through.
Well, I want to leave with the idea of pricing. Paulson has said that he, if he gets this money, will be pricing these distressed assets and then buying them for the Federal Treasury. Once that happens, does then he have the ability to basically set the world price, or will he be competing with some other price?
No, I mean, to a large extent, that is a key element of uncertainty. What is the price at which these assets are going to be taken over? Because on the one hand, it's got to, I mean, if he buys them too cheaply, I mean, if he doesn't pay enough for them, then the U.S. taxpayer is going to lose out. But if he doesn't pay enough for them, then the financial system is still going to have a lot of problems.
Well, that's the perfect proposition.
Getting that balance right is absolutely crucial.
All right, Chris Brown-Humes, thanks so much for joining us. Chris Brown-Humes, speaking with us from London, is the markets editor for the London Financial Times. Adar?
Certainly lots of people on that list of wait and see, and more specifically right now we're going to take a look at taxpayers and what this proposed bailout potentially means. And for that, we turn to Professor Stephen Davidoff, who blogs for the New York Times as the Deal Professor. His most recent entry is entitled, How Much Will It Really Cost? Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. And I want to say that I'm very happy to ask for the $700 billion for myself.
Nice. Good job, Stephen.
That sounded very sincere since it came right off the cuff. But let's get down to business here. Are taxpayers going to benefit from this bailout?
Well, it's hard to say. Right now, if we can restore market stability and get credit restored so banks will deal with one another and deal with corporations, this will benefit consumers. The problem that we have right now is we basically have no idea what's in this bill. We had a three-page bill that Henry Paulson sent to Congress over the weekend. The bill is remarkably short. It's expanding exponentially. But in its initial form, it gave Paulson carte blanche to buy and sell these assets at the prices that he deemed appropriate. And depending upon what he pays for them or not, the bailout could cost hundreds of billions of dollars, the government could actually make a profit here.
Before we get to the valuation question, can we first answer something I've heard many people ask, which is it tax dollars that will pay for those assets?
Absolutely. This is government money on the line. And I think it's also important to remember the $700 billion figure that is thrown around. The government is not, it's not just going away. The government is getting assets in return. So it is highly likely that this number will be well south of $700 billion. But still, the government has to raise $700 billion in the markets. As you know, if you take on more money, you're more risky. That's what the government is doing. It's taking a risky bet.
You note that the government is getting assets in return, but that's the problem. What kinds of assets? How much are they worth? How much is the government going to pay for them? And are they ever going to be able to sell them?
You hit the nail on the head. The problem that we have now is that with giving Paulson absolute authority, he can overpay for these assets and subsidize these banks, and the government will take the loss. So the battle that's going on in Congress right now is trying to put some authority on Paulson so that we can ensure that in having $700 billion to play with, unprecedented for any person in the history of the United States, Paulson will be sure to take the steps that protect the American taxpayer.
So Paulson will be able to get tables ahead of Bill Gates, I guess, at the major restaurants in New York and in the Silicon Valley. Well, Professor, you know, I rarely ask the legal questions with Adora in the studio, but what is the precedent? What is the precedent for having that kind of discretion? I mean, is it the same as the discretion, say, the Secretary of Defense has in pricing fighter jets that Paulson will have in pricing these assets?
Well, the problem that we have is that we have an administration that has a poor record with unfettered discretion.
You noticed that, yeah.
And so without delving into the politics of this, there really is no precedent for an administrative authority to have this type of authority generally and just on these numbers. I'd like to add also that we're getting something which is not surprising, which is bailout creep. And reports are that the initial proposal was only for mortgage-related assets. Overnight, it turned into troubled assets, which means anything that Henry Paulson deems troubled, such as the automaker's loans, credit card loans.
Corporate junk bonds?
Yes, hopefully my loans.
I see.
You'd like to add your name to the list of people who are asking for a check?
Well, I will say that I do own a house in Michigan and Ohio, so I would be happy for any help I can get.
Good states.
But
yes.
Seriously, though, I mean, not to completely joke about it, I mean, who will be able to apply to say they have distressed assets that should be part of this bailout? Anyone?
Well, we don't know yet, but it's lost in congressional hearings right now. But presumably, there will be a record in the discussions of what are troubled assets. And these are likely to be more than banks and can expand possibly to the automakers, to Sallie Mae, who gives student loans.
Oh, student loans, sure, sure. Well,
credit card companies. And again, we'll need to see what comes out of the bill. We just don't know. This is
right.
Lost right now
right.
In the fog of war and congressional negotiations.
We're going to have to leave it there. Stephen M. Davidoff, professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law. Thank you.
And now to the rest of you, take a breath, all right? And in your most convincing voice, ask me and the rest of America for $700 billion.
Harry from Bergen County. I forgot to go to the ATM this morning. Do you think you have $700 billion you can lend me just until, I don't know, a year from now?
Hopefully, Hank Paulson will have a more convincing argument than Harry does, but any arguments from you are welcome at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And we should just note, passing the wires just moments ago, Fed Chair Bernanke urges quick action on the $700 billion financial bailout, warning that the economy faces grave dangers. That, according to the Associated Press, just moments ago.
He's got to make a pitch. $700 billion.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, and Henry Paulson are going to be testifying before Congress, and they'll be talking about the $700 billion bailout that is before Capitol Hill right now. We were asking you for your most convincing voice in asking for $700 billion by, say, Thursday, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Nathan in Woburn, Massachusetts, sent us an email. Hello, America. I need you to give me $700 billion because my dog ate my mortgage. That works for you? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at TheTakeaway.org.
Okay, we're going to switch gears here and talk about the U.S. Armed Forces. Between the active members and reservists, there's somewhere around 2.3 million Americans who are serving, many of them serving overseas now as we are fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. So who is in this fighting force? Joining us right now is Freakonomics co-author Stephen Dubner.
Freak out. Ooh, Freakonomics.
You're
a good dancer. You're a good dancer, Dora. I've
Freak
never seen
out.
That.
Yes. Well, we like we like your anthem. So, Stephen, what do you got for us? Break this down. Who is in the armed forces?
Well, this was a surprise to me. It may not be a surprise to other people.
Well, what motivated you to even take a look
well,
at this?
Well, a few things. Yeah. Personal, political, and datical, if datical is a word. It's fun to look at data.
I'll look it up.
To look at data when you see it. So the personal was the fact that I looked around and I find that a lot of the people who are going into the military in the last year that I know are people from middle and upper middle class families. So a nephew of mine who's from a solidly middle class family decided to join. The daughter of a friend of mine who runs a law firm. This is the youngest of three children. The older one's an engineer. The other's in finance, although maybe not for long. And the third one became an ROTC officer. And I thought, you know, and then we watched the political conventions.
Right.
Bo Biden's speech got a lot of attention for a lot of reasons, which gets you to thinking, well,
he's going off to Iraq.
Right. He's going off to Iraq.
Biden's son.
How valuable is it that for the Democratic ticket that the VP candidate has a son who's about to go off to Iraq, albeit as an older guy who's not going to be in combat? Then we see, of course, that Sarah Palin, the Republican VP candidate, has a young son who's going off to Iraq. How anomalous is this, I wondered. And so you go and look at the numbers and you find
that— Anomalous in the sense that these kinds of families from this socioeconomic group have members in the military.
The articles that I read, mm-hmm. the TV news reports that I see tend to reinforce the image that our armed forces are full of low-income soldiers who have very little option in life other than the military.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the data, now the data that I'm looking at, and this raises skepticism among a lot of people, comes from a Heritage Foundation report by the group called the Center for Data Analysis out of the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation does not have the best record for presenting clear-eyed, non-ideological data. And yet, and I have some qualms with this report. It's a new report, and it's easy to slice and dice data to make the argument that you want. But that said, the armed forces right now, as they now exist, are The personnel in the armed forces are better educated and from much higher income families than we think. The top 40% of the household income families in the U.S. produce more than 50% of our armed services.
Hmm.
Okay,
so it's more like the Napoleonic era where you have a sort of warrior class.
Well, I wouldn't quite put it that way because, you have to look at the reason that people are joining. They're joining for educational opportunities. They're joining for travel opportunities. Some are joining because it is the one and only option. But the conception that the military is staffed largely by the bottom of the barrel, that's really the unspoken charge that's usually levied, is entirely wrong, both in terms of education and income. Now, you could also say, well, wait a minute, low income and low education go together. And this Heritage Foundation boasts that more than 90% of Army recruits have a high school diploma. In fact, well more than 90%, although there's a lot of controversy over that one point, I should add. But that's a little bit of a false boast,
but
because
also,
it's a requirement for joining the Army.
But isn't your premise more generational, perhaps? Couldn't you argue that that would have been the case, say, in the 70s as opposed to today? Because when you do look at the images, and I've certainly done my share of stories, not only on the ground in Iraq and other places, but also of soldiers here in the United States. And over this past 7 years, we really see a large variety of people, from the reservists who are in their 40s and private business owners, all the way down to the 18-year-old who comes from small-town USA. So aren't we seeing those images of a very varied armed forces?
I don't know. I think it's hard to say who the we is. When you say, aren't we seeing the images? I think if you
stories that the media is doing in print, on television,
let me say this.
On the radio.
I think if you depend largely on media images, and by media I would include film as well, I think the perception is not that. I think the perception is that the military now, look, I mean, you know, you read about the backdoor draft, you read about all the different instances in which military personnel are kind of shanghaied or press ganged into service, and you would assume that these are people with very few options. This report makes it clear that there are options for these people.
But what
this
about
report,
when we...
Just 1 second, though. This report doesn't deal with the reserve. It deals mostly with the enlistees, right?
Reserve
is a slightly different issue.
Reserve is different. It actually deals with enlistees and officers.
Right.
The officer corps is an entirely different story.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you can expect, that does come from a higher income household. Yeah.
Because the flip side of this also, or I should say another issue about this, is that the armed forces are the most integrated unit out of any corporation or organization in the United States of America.
True.
And so we definitely see that picture a very diverse group.
And look, I don't want to be a military apologist, but I will tell you this. From working for several years at the New York Times and still having an affiliation there, and having spent some time at West Point on a variety of kind of research projects and knowing people from a variety of military segments, I'm always shocked at the degree to which there is, if not an active ignorance, a kind of casual ignorance of the way the military functions and what it represents within the media, okay? And I've always thought, you know, for an institution, the New York Times, it lies just down the river from West Point, which is a very interesting institution, which has a lot of interesting philosophies, a lot of interesting accomplishments. I wish that people would look at military service and the statistics behind it a little more calmly and deeply.
So very interesting.
That's what this
Dubner,
blog is about. Yeah,
yeah, Stephen Dubner is going to hang with us for a little while.
Just one, can I ask Stephen just one tiny little thing? Stephen, can you ask me for $700 billion quickly?
John, if you don't give me $700 billion, I'm going to kill every puppy in America.
Okay.
Oh,
right.
My.
That was convincing.
So
and then I'm going to Canada.
And on that note, we turn to Femi with headlines.
Thank you very much. He's a worrying man, but we do like having him on the program. 29 minutes past the hour, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke are testifying before a Senate panel this morning. They're defending the proposed $700 billion financial bailout plan. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is also before Congress today. He's expected to say that more troops are needed in Afghanistan. And also in Afghanistan, relatives of some prisoners held at Bagram Air Base are being allowed to visit for the first time. The Red Cross have been pushing for years for the face-to-face visits. That's a quick look at some of the main headlines from this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the role of fertility treatments in helping women have multiple births to accommodate their careers and lifestyles. Is it responsible? Is it ethical? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As the whole world and world markets watch what's going on Capitol Hill as the $700 billion financial bailout is discussed, it's time for you to make your case. Pitch us your personal bailout.
Uncle Sam, I did some stupid decisions with my friend Buddy. So I'm going to need some cash. And you know what? Can I come back tomorrow for some more?
You didn't give a dollar amount, but tell us your pitch at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Quite seriously, though, economic downturns and particularly financial collapses like this are of particular interest to people who are dependent on philanthropic giving from the corporate community. Joining us from Washington is Stacey Palmer, the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Stacey, good morning.
Good morning.
And Mark Shamley is also with us. He's president of the Association of Corporate Contribution Professionals. He's on the line from Orlando. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
So, Stacey, when you open the financial pages and read these kinds of headlines, what do you think the impact is on, you know, the kind of work that you do?
It's huge. Nonprofit leaders across the country are really worried about what's going to happen to their finances, because not only do they have to worry about the corporations collapsing, but everybody's looking at their stock portfolios and saying, oh my goodness, do I have enough money to be able to comfortably give? And this is the big giving time of year, so it's a pretty nervous time.
Mark Shamley, are sectors more heavily involved in this downturn than others, certain kinds of nonprofits? Are they insulated, others more vulnerable?
Well, I think if you look at a sector-by-sector approach, obviously there are some sectors that are doing well, for example, your petroleum companies. But when you look across the financial industry, there's obviously tremendous concern. And when you look particularly at that industry, they have an incredible amount of support, philanthropic support, that is driving down to the nonprofit sector. So I believe it is, as Stacey indicated, is of deep concern.
Well, Mark, how do you consult with a client and encourage them to give or strategize with them to give when they're laying off employees and they're watching their net worth sort of plummet?
One of the things that we talk to our members about is the importance of investing. And with these investments, these are typically long-term kinds of activities as opposed to one-off contributions. And we really stress the idea of building social capital in the marketplace that's of interest to them. I think it would not be in their best interest, corporations, to abandon the social capital that they've built over time. Plus, consumers and stakeholders have indicated that this is an important activity that they expect companies to be involved in.
Stacey, do you go along with that?
It certainly is, but whether, when push comes to shove, companies will be able to do that is a really big question. So we're expecting it's going to be a pretty tight year. So some companies will continue to give, but certainly there are going to be a lot of cutbacks. And that's at the same time that government is also probably going to cut back, because tax revenues aren't going to be as high. And government provides a lot of the money to nonprofits as well. Plus, more people are coming to them for services. So even if companies keep going a little bit, it's still not enough to take care of all the needs.
And Stacey, according to one of the surveys that the Chronicle did, I mean, we're talking big money. For example, Merrill Lynch awarded $43.7 million in 2007, and Lehman Brothers gave $39 million in 2007. Obviously, Lehman's in bankruptcy, so that money's probably not coming, and Merrill Lynch is a big question mark. How do you plan around that now?
Nonprofits that depend on some of those companies have started looking for other sources, and it's possible that some of that money that has been committed will keep going. But for organizations that got a lot of money, they just have to look for other sources. You know, they'll look beyond the corporate community to other kinds of things as well. There are a lot of wealthy donors who, even though they may have lost a lot of money, still have plenty to give away. So I think some of those donors will step up. So you'll see the big philanthropists, the big name ones, starting to step in and doing some good for groups that are about to falter.
Stacey and Mark, Stephen Dubner from our Freakonomics blog is with us. He has a question. Go ahead, Stephen.
I wonder if you could just give us a picture, if you could imagine. I know this is a broad question, but I'm asking for specifics. What might we expect to see changing in the landscape in terms of goods and services in the next couple of years? For instance, in New York City, a very salient fact that a lot of people don't know is 85% of Central Park's budget comes from private money from the Central Park Conservancy. So if you can look down the road, tell us, how will the world actually change as a result of this hit on charitable contributions from these kind of folks?
Well, I think one of the things that's going to happen is companies are going to pull back on some of the sponsorship activities that they've engaged in, dinners and things of that nature, and really focus on core giving, things that are actually benefiting the local community. Some of the activities that are probably on the fringe that really don't have a net benefit to a particular group, I think companies are going to look at those and scrutinize those kinds of contributions.
Stacey, what do you think is going to change?
I would agree. I think a lot of groups that serve the public are going to probably have to merge, or some of them may close, and some of those may be services that a lot of people depend on but just can't attract enough public support.
So, when you say services that people depend on, are we talking about, however, arts, or are we talking about, let's say, food banks?
I would say both. Kinds of things, but social services groups, which have the most need, unfortunately also do the worst in fundraising, and a lot of people don't realize that those groups are in great need, and so, you know, those are the ones that are the most precarious.
Stacey Palmer, thank you. Stacey is the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and thanks also to Mark Shamley, who's president of the Association of Corporate Contribution Professionals. Consolidation there at both ends, at the bank end and at the nonprofit end. And now headlines from Femi Okay.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush will address the UN General Assembly later this morning for the last time as president. He's expected to defend his administration's proposed $700 billion bailout. He's meeting now with Pakistan's newly elected leader, Asif al-Zardari. And Sarah Palin's using the gathering of world leaders to beef up her foreign credentials. In the next 2 days, she'll meet with leaders from Colombia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Georgia, Ukraine and India, and Henry Kissinger and Bono. Treasury Chief Hank Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke are answering Congress's questions about the $700 billion bailout plan on Capitol Hill this morning. In western Finland, 9 people were shot to death by a fellow student at an adult vocational school. He then shot himself. And finally, it could take 2 years to travel 7 miles, possibly the world's slowest journey. The Mars rover Opportunity is set to make a 2-year trip towards the crater Endeavour, and along the way, we'll send back information about rocks and soil. We spoke earlier this morning to Heidi Hamill. She's the co-director and senior researcher at the Space Science Institute. And Heidi explains what's so special about the Endeavour crater.
This is a much larger crater than we've been to in the past. And what's good about that is it means it's deeper, and we can then explore into the surface of Mars deeper than we've done before.
Now, it is possible that Opportunity might not make its final destination. It's traveling about 110 yards a day.
Go, Opportunity, go.
And
go, you'll make it. Give up.
It's a little wobbly.
You can
don't
sort of
up,
visualize the poor thing wobbling along with that broken wheel.
America's with you.
NASA is calling it new science.
Thank you, Femi.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji. Good morning.
Good morning, and I'm John Hockenberry. Now, follow the logic here, all right? We own AIG, the insurance giant, right? Because we bailed them out, all right? AIG sponsors a lot of stuff, okay?
A lot.
Including the New Jersey Symphony. They sponsor the broadcasts, the radio broadcasts for the New Jersey Symphony. They sponsor the Buffalo Bisons. The minor league baseball team.
What that was, because I didn't know.
They're a major league baseball team that didn't make it to 500 in the latest season. Too bad for them. They're actually a Mets farm team. And they also are the biggest sponsor for Manchester United, the soccer legend. And joining us now to talk about, first of all, how Manchester United is doing and what this AIG sponsorship means. I mean, after all, it is our team, right?
Yes.
And there we go. Jeff Rusnak is soccer columnist for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, how's Manchester United doing?
Well, a little bit of a slow start this year. It's just 4 games in for Man United, and they're in 15th place in the English Premier League out of 20 teams.
Oh.
I know. This isn't what we expect for $85 billion, but they're 1 game away, really. They have a game in hand, so if they were to win their next game and they would be even with all the teams in terms of games played. They would jump up to eighth. I would say the near-term prospect is for a quick turnaround. The long-term prospect is for Man United to continue to make a healthy return on investment. So I think we got a pretty good deal, although $85 billion is a lot to spend to get, you know, a soccer team.
Well, Jeff, you know, I was listening to what you're saying there. You know, AIG has had kind of a slow start for the fall, too. You know, they're having a little rough time. I don't know if the turnaround is going to work there. But what does this sponsorship consist of?
Well, basically, in lieu of not having television commercials during a soccer match,
right.
And, you know, soccer teams throughout the world sell the front of their jersey as more or less a billboard. And there are varying values to that. The deal that AIG has with Man United happens to be the most expensive deal of all of them. It's $102.9 million over 4 years, and AIG is now in the second year of that deal. And essentially what it gives AIG is, particularly with a team like Manchester United, is probably, oh gosh, easily in the tens of millions of people seeing that logo on a weekly basis around the world. I think AIG is in 130 countries, but I think the English Premier League is in about 190 countries in terms of television coverage. So
now it's all about branding, Jeff. So I mean, when people see that jersey with AIG on it, are they thinking to themselves, strong, powerful, Manchester United, or are they thinking bankrupt, loser, owned by the U.S. taxpayers?
Well, this occurred to me last night that, you know, the current administration that we have isn't very popular around the world. And, you know, now you associate them with Manchester United. You know, this might be a deal that if we didn't have an election coming up and, you know, and this whole imaging could change, you know, might not be the best association. You're right. I mean, AIG right now is a damaged product, and Manchester United is a defending English champion and European
right.
champion.
Jeff, so, really quickly, we just got a couple of seconds. I mean, we really have 1 second. What's your advice for your team? I mean, you're one of the sponsors. Come on. What should they do?
Well, you know, we just need to stay healthy. We've
stay
got
healthy.
More millionaires on our team than anybody else.
Beautiful.
Just remember, America, AIG, 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 not USA.
Jeff Rusnak, soccer columnist for the South Florida Sun Sentinel.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Tuesday, September 23rd. Femi Okeh has just joined us with a few headlines. Femi.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush is expected to use his address this morning before the UN's General Assembly to defend his administration's aggressive financial bailout plan. Treasury Chief Hank Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke will be on Capitol Hill today to defend the plan. So far, overseas markets have been calmer than yesterday. In western Finland, a male student shot and killed 9 people at a vocational school before shooting himself. In Afghanistan, relatives of prisoners held at Bagram Air Force Base are being allowed to visit detainees for the first time. This Red Cross pushed for the visits, and they say that face-to-face visits are required by international humanitarian law. On the campaign trail, the candidates were talking about taxes yesterday. John McCain, speaking on NBC's Today show, said that he would go easy on taxes during this tough economic time.
I will not raise taxes in a time of a hurting economy because it will hurt our ability to recover from this. I am opposed to new taxes.
Senator Barack Obama says that his plan has more tax relief than McCain's.
If you are making less than $250,000, you will not see a dime in increased taxes, not a single dime in increased taxes when I am president of the United States.
And the first presidential debate will take place this Friday and will focus on foreign policy. Let's look at your news for now.
Thanks, Fem.
So, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is asking for $700 billion to deal with the nation's financial crisis. Pitch us your bailout. But we're also hearing from you about philanthropies struggling during this time, too.
John, Dartmouth, I've worked for nonprofits. I respect nonprofits. When charitable contributions start getting pulled back because of the economy, for the first time in their existence, nonprofits are going to learn to be efficient and not feel that they can always practice their business in the red.
Call us with your take at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We've also gotten a lot of questions for Barney Frank, who was unable to be with us today. We suspect he will be able to join us before the end of the week, so keep your questions coming.
And certainly, financial troubles have, a lot of people are feeling the pinch, and they've essentially spread all over the world, and in many places, voters want some accountability. Many leaders are feeling that pressure. That includes America's staunch ally in Britain, Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Some in his own party have called for him to step down, though elections are not scheduled for 2 years. The BBC's Paddy O'Connell joins us from London to take a look at the backlash against incumbent politicians worldwide. Hey there, Paddy.
Good morning, Adora.
So Brown's party, the Labour Party, is meeting this week. Is it make or break for him?
It's not in a day. But look, you said it. Around the world, leaders are reaching for the bat phone. You know, George Bush was given 10 seconds at the Republican convention, so popular is he. They've had an election in Australia where the guy who was in since the dinosaurs was kicked out. They've got problems wherever they are, the leaders, because of the financial climate, basically. And Gordon Brown, who was our finance secretary, our Chancellor of the Exchequer, is deeply unpopular, and his party have been whispering in the wings about what to do about it.
What specifically is going on in Britain that's really driving this discontent?
We were the guys who queued, who got in line outside our banks to withdraw our deposits 1 year ago. I don't know if you remember those scenes, but we were first to say we've got concerns that can our banks give us back our money. That's the worst nightmare for banks, and that happened here a year ago. We also had institutions that would lend you 125% of the value of your home. So they would lend you an extra 25%. Now, house prices have been falling, and British people are feeling the backlash from this global economic crisis. And therefore, they're feeling that the times are changing, and they're blaming Gordon Brown because he was in charge for much of the last 10 years of the economy.
And he took credit during those many years of prosperity there in the UK.
Yes, he basically said that he'd abolished the cycle of boom and bust. Now, no one can feel that he's entirely to blame for these problems, and fair-minded listeners of yours and fair-minded voters wouldn't say it's all one guy's fault. But his problem is that he's not as charismatic as his predecessor, Tony Blair, and he's also connected with taking credit for the good times. And in the middle of that, he's being nutcrackered. And we're a parliamentary system, so the British people don't get a say on whether to change him. It's his party who are meeting at the moment, and he's got a speech in 2 hours.
Right. Well, you know, Paddy, I'm curious about this whole party business. I mean, you mentioned all these other incumbents around the world, and a large majority of them have been ousted because of mechanisms within their party. It's as though, you know, voters, who needs them? We'll do it in our party back room. How do people in the UK take that? Is that, like, no problem?
Well, I think you could start from where you're sitting. American friends of mine find this to be the most ridiculous part of our system. Basically, Margaret Thatcher, one of the most famous prime ministers of the 20th century, was replaced not by the people, but by the Conservative Party. They said, all right, we think you can't do it anymore, goodbye. They got rid of her. Tony Blair was our prime minister, and he stood down, and Gordon Brown took over. There was no reference to the people. That was an internal matter. So all of this question in a parliamentary system is left for the party, not for the people. And people find that, you know, to be that they knew it, but they don't necessarily like it.
Is our primary system, I mean, Paddy, this is Stephen Dubner. I address this not just to you, but to John and Adora as well. Is our primary system in this country really so different than theirs? I mean, if you think about how much the party has to do with the ascension of the candidate.
Well, but except the...
Obviously it's different, but I think that we're
this
giving
is a,
these
this
systems
is a matter
short
of,
shrift.
Yeah, Maggie, you sit down, you know, go, you stand up, you know, it's as simple as that. And they did the same thing in Israel. It's like now Tzipi Lipni is
It does. But I think that if we think that our political system is so much more of a free market than these other political systems, I think we're deluding ourselves a little
bit.
Well,
hang on a minute. You go into the voting machine in November, they give you a punch card as big as a telephone directory. You've got all this choice to make.
Well, by then you've got it narrowed down to two, correct? But the point that I'm making is this. Before it gets narrowed down to two, when it's being narrowed down from 10 to 1 on each side, the party wields...
No. It would be like Bush stepping down, saying, I'm done here. Let's have Newt Gingrich, take over for me until the election.
Sarah Palin, come on, love. Why don't you do the job?
That's right.
You bring your gun and you do it.
Yeah.
Also, it's like the Democrats, they were always the people, always critics of the Democrat Party said, do you always get into a room and you sort this out, in the old days? So that what's happening in Britain is that we can change our prime minister and we do not have to go to the people. That's the truth here. And I think Americans would say that's death and taxes added together in one sandwich.
Yeah, I think he's right.
Yeah, but then, Patty, you can also argue, and this will be the last question, you could also argue, though, that the pressure that Gordon Brown is facing today is coming from members of his party. And they're feeling the pressure about who the voters are going to pick, given the polls where you have for the first time in a long time, the Conservative Party is looking a little brighter to most Britons than the Labour Party is.
That's right. And I think you've left it if you've got your fair-minded takeaway listeners and they want to say, look, I'm tired, I've got to go to work, tell me the one thing I need to know. It's basically that we are feeling what you're feeling. And in our system, the gears are crunching in the ruling Labour Party. And there's a big speech and the guy will survive. But this question is going to go on and we'll ask it another time.
Patty O'Connell, thank you. And we'll be looking for you for some answers. Patty's coming to us from the BBC. And Stephen Dubner, thank you to you too, co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog.
Lots of ways to catch up with us here at The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, Facebook. We're talking about the turbulent international markets and who's really doing the fighting in Iraq.
We're also talking a lot about the proposed $700 billion bailout. It's time to make your case.
Yeah, John, it's me, Wimpy from Popeye. I don't know if you remember me. Several years back, I would love to borrow $700 million today, and I would gladly pay you on Tuesday. Really, I will. Thanks.
Only $700 million. Well, hey, Wimp, sure, we can come up with that. That's easy. Here's your takeaway.
We've got more millionaires on our team than anybody else. And just remember, America, AIG, 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 not USA.
Hey, we're all sponsors of Manchester United. That was Jeff Rusnak, a soccer columnist for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, with Manchester United sponsor AIG unraveling. That's Jeff's suggestion on how the team should pitch itself.
And by the way, if you're not sure what you think about the candidates, the presidential candidates, that is, we've got a new tool for you on Facebook. It's called Who Should I Vote For? And you enter three qualities you'd like in your next president and other Facebook users. So they will tell you who you should vote for. You can also tell us what you think of the candidates always at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Or you can go to our website and check out some links to the game, thetakeaway.org.
But mostly, just pick up the phone and dial 877-8-MY-TAKE, and in your best, most convincing voice, do what Hank Paulson is doing today. Ask for $700 billion. Just, maybe you asked your dad to co-sign for a loan. That was hard. But imagine this. Hey, I need $700 billion by Thursday. How's that sound? It's a takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Okay, my fellow Americans. To save the world economy, here's your chance. Take a deep breath, and in your most convincing voice, ask me for $700 billion.
John, I need $700 billion by Thursday. No questions asked. Please.
John, this is Leroy. I need $700 billion by Thursday.
Okay, what do you need it for?
Well, it's an emergency right now. I wouldn't ask if I didn't need it.
All right, I'll see what I can do, Leroy.
I would appreciate it.
Hi, this is Rena from Manhattan. I'd love $700 billion to help fix the education system. In New York City, in this country, $700 billion would help a lot.
a cool $700 billion, how would you spend it on The Takeaway?
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 23rd, and I'm going to take that assignment seriously, and I'm going to come up with a really long list of things that I would do with $700 billion.
Yeah, you got to convince me to give it to you first. Good morning, Adora.
As does the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. Major questions today about his ability, as well as the Bush administration's ability, to execute a $700 billion bailout of Wall Street. He will be on Capitol Hill asking Congress for the money. Oil prices jumped up and down yet again. The markets are clearly anxious. Also, new technology in India studies the brain to find someone guilty of murder. It is controversial. The Mars rover sets its sights on the galaxy, and Congress grapples another day on that bailout plan. We'll go live to the Capitol. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke will be on Capitol Hill in just about a half hour from now to defend their proposed bailout plan. Congressional leaders are haggling over the details as markets overseas watch. They've been calmer than yesterday. U.S. markets look to set to open flat. The Dow lost more than 3% yesterday. Oil is trading above 106 in Asian trading. That's down from yesterday's enormous spike.
The U.N. General Assembly gets underway here in New York City today, with the world economic crisis expected to overshadow the proceedings. President George Bush's final address will focus on his decision to sanction the financial bailout after years of advocating deregulation. New census data confirms that housing costs are eating up as much as half of the incomes of 7.5 million Americans.
That's actually a huge story. In Afghanistan, meanwhile, the Red Cross says prisoners held by the U.S. military at Bagram Air Base will be allowed face-to-face visits from family members today. The visits will last an hour. NASA has a new mission for the Mars rover Opportunity. The rickety little rover will make a 7-mile journey to explore a large crater. It could take up to 2 years to get there. And politics today, John McCain will be in Ohio and Michigan. Barack Obama is in Tampa prepping for Friday's presidential debate. Boy, that's going to be a huge event.
Okay, what's your pitch, John? $700 billion. Why should I give that to you?
It's going to save the world economy. Give me $700 billion by Thursday. Come on.
What's your
pitch? That's not very convincing, but you can be better than that. You can be convincing. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Somebody's got to do better than Hank Paulson, right? MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Pitch us your $700 billion bailout.
Why should you get it? Why should the government give it to you? And what are you going to do with it? Perhaps that should be part of the pitch to explain exactly where the money's going. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Adora, listen to this quick email. Dear American, I am Ministry of the Treasury of the Republic of America. My country has had crisis that has caused the need for large transfer of funds, $700 billion U.S. If you would assist me, it would be most profitable to you. That's straight off of Boing Boing. The $700 billion bailout in the that's being debated on Capitol Hill has the entire world watching. The details are being ironed out on Capitol Hill, and we've been getting responses from you all week.
My name is Tricia Wu, calling from Joplin, Missouri. Sometimes it's necessary to bail out big companies to ensure the trickle-down doesn't affect the smaller American.
My name is Crystal Albright. I'm calling from Covington, Georgia. I have mounting bills. I can't turn around to the government and say, hey, I'm not going to pay my taxes. Yet we are always constantly bailing out these companies where their CEOs are making hundreds of thousands of dollars. Don't see where it's fair.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars? Hundreds of thousands? Well, in his spectacular piece in the New York Times this morning, Peter Goodman of the Times calls Wall Street home of the eight-figure salary. The piece is entitled experts see a need for punitive action in bailout, and it's some spectacular analysis. Peter Goodman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, what is that about? It seems as though Congress is looking for someone to take some pain if Congress is going to shell out all of this money. How's that debate taking place?
Well, there's a serious pushback to this proposal, and it's on multiple fronts. I mean, one, there is a sense that this might not be the best way to go about trying to fix up the financial system, that we might need to give taxpayers something more than sort of the comfort that, you know, the whole world isn't falling down on them for their trouble and their dollars. We ought to maybe give the taxpayer some of the upside, some stock in the companies that are going to get the bailouts. So if they are in fact fixed, the government can sell the stock and make a profit. But there's also a larger sense that, that there's a sense of distrust that, you know, here's this administration that has a record of saying we have an emergency confronting us, whether it's a national security issue or now a financial issue, and you have to act fast, Congress. You have to give us special powers right now so we can address this crisis. And, you know, people are looking at the war in Iraq. They're looking at the way the wiretapping bill and the debate over it has played out, and they're saying, I'm not so sure I want to give these guys more special authority.
You know, one of the people who we've been asking their impression of the bailout sent us an email that I think is pretty interesting. I mean, you know, Hank Paulson used to be chairman at the Goldman Sachs from 1994 to 2006. You know, he's worth $700 million all by himself. Is it a conflict of interest that so many Wall Street characters, and you could talk to about Robert Rubin in the Clinton administration as well, is it a conflict of interest that so many of these characters are actually designing these kinds of Treasury bailouts?
Well, there's certainly the perception of that. I mean, the Paulson bill, at least as it was first outlined over the weekend, essentially says, Congress, give me $700 billion. I'll use that money to buy up these toxic leftovers, these bad loans that are choking the financial system as I see fit. There won't be any oversight. I'll just spend that money as I feel I must to fix this crisis. And the first question is, well, what are you going to pay for this stuff that's sitting on the balance sheets? I mean, if you're going to pay market rate, how does that change anything? I mean, these banks could be unloading these bad loans today at whatever the market rate is. The problem is nobody really knows what the market rate is, and there isn't a market because nobody wants to touch this stuff. So you're going to have to pay some premium to get them to unload it. And who's going to decide what that premium is exactly? Now, there are plenty of people who say, well, the Treasury Secretary is acting honorably. We might have a disagreement over how best to structure this thing, but, you know, let's not question his integrity. But there are other people who say this is somebody who has spent, you know, most of his adult life on Wall Street, seeing the world through the lens of a large investment bank, and when it comes down to it, believes that what's best for Wall Street is what's best for Main Street. That may be true. I mean, we can have a debate about that, but this isn't necessarily the person who's best placed to address the interests of the taxpayer.
And Peter, according to your reporting, that skepticism really runs very deep. I mean, you certainly have lots of critics on both sides of the aisle in terms of political parties. And one interesting point that you make is there's this great quote from a former Federal Reserve Board economist who says, thank goodness, their initial reaction by the market is, thank goodness the cavalry is coming, but what exactly is the cavalry going to do? And that's really the heart of what you're saying, is that many people aren't sure whether or not Bernanke and Paulson are the ones to make the accurate judgment as to what exactly needs to be done.
Well, I mean, the same people who've been saying repeatedly this crisis is contained are now saying, give us $700 billion or, you know, the apocalypse happens tomorrow.
Hello. No. I mean, that's the interesting thing. And to have the cavalry come in, as Adora says in that quote, you know, doesn't really have a very nuanced view of the separation of powers. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that's somebody, Doug Elmendorf at Brookings, who's saying we do need to do something. And there are a lot of economists who think we do need to do something. There's a debate over, you know, what do we do? But, yeah, there is a sense of why are we doing this in such haste? If we're going to spend this sort of money, shouldn't we make sure that the taxpayers' interests are addressed, that we get some help for people whose homes are being foreclosed so we don't have the ugly situation where we're effectively bailing out executives, you know, who bought up beach houses and, you know, have filled up their bank bank accounts, with the public now picking up the tab for what are clearly some very reckless bets. So there's a sense of let's pause a little bit and sort of catch our breath and make sure we do this the right way if we're going to write a big check.
I mean, that's a serious issue because it is abundantly unclear what the Secretary of Treasury, what's his intention in terms of the taxpayers. I mean, it has not been articulated how we taxpayers either benefit or don't from the bailout or from what would happen if there wasn't this overhaul.
Well, I mean, there is a serious argument to be made, and one that a lot of economists buy, that, I mean, you can't have the financial system just collapse here, and it looked pretty scary before we started talking about bailouts. I mean, we had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which everybody now seems to know, you know, guarantee somewhere around $5 trillion worth of American mortgages potentially going down. We had AIG, which, you know, insures against corporate defaults potentially going down. And if the financial system doesn't work, how do we finance college? How do we finance houses and cars and, you know, a lot of other things that Americans care about?
You mentioned AIG, Peter. Did you realize you were a sponsor as a taxpayer of, you know, the Buffalo Bisons baseball team and Manchester United and also the New Jersey Symphony?
Congratulations.
Pretty cool. I know. Yeah. I'm feeling pretty good today. You talked earlier about if there is an upside for the taxpayer in terms of getting something of value, it would involve taking equity stakes in certain institutions. Is there precedent for that? And how is that different from, say, nationalizing the banks, if that's what they did, say, in Chile?
Yeah, there is precedent. That's essentially what happened in Sweden in the early 90s. And that's an example that a lot of people now cite
as a socialist country, by the way.
That's right. Chrysler in the late 70s, the government got warrants and profited on the upside when the stock turned around. I mean, that's been done before.
And, you know, Republicans being at the head of this sort of thing, does
exactly.
that seem like an irony?
Exactly.
Well, I mean, there are concerns about that, too. I mean, a lot of economists are uncomfortable with the idea that the American government is all of a sudden going to own big chunks of the financial system. I mean, you know, somewhere between here and you know, serious ownership, we turn into the Chinese financial system. I mean, that's not something that anybody wants.
Peter, what's your best guesstimation as to how this valuation process is going to take place? How much are these quote-unquote toxic assets worth, and will anybody buy them?
Hey, if I knew that, I'd be too busy making a fortune to be talking to you guys.
Right, yeah.
I mean, nobody knows. The biggest problem here is that these assets, these are not like stocks and bonds where there's some exchange and you can look up at the board and say, well, a share of this costs X. These are very sophisticated, complicated investments created by taking millions of mortgages, pooling them together, chopping them into little pieces, different shaped and sized pieces. This is the way in which the financial system, you know, sold this stuff, bought this stuff, borrowed against it.
And so the pricing, we're writing the pricing just as much as we're writing the law. Quickly before we go, is there any precedent for holding salaries to some minimum or maximum?
I don't know that there's precedent. There's a lot of talk of that. It's unclear whether that's going to enter the mix. It's much more likely that when a deal is struck, we will have some sort of taxpayer equity share in bailed out companies.
But actually regulating executives' compensation, that's going to be a much more difficult issue. Peter Goodman, thanks so much for joining us. Terrific article in the Times today. Experts see a need for punitive action in bailout. Within the last few minutes, President Bush spoke at the Waldorf Astoria across town. He's in town for the UN meeting. He said he is confident that Congress will reconcile differences and come together to pass that $700 billion bailout bill to deal with the financial meltdown. I've assured them that both leaders of Congress are going to get something done quickly. That's President Bush.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. On this Tuesday, September 23rd, the big story here in the U.S. is Congress, and they're grappling with a $700 billion bailout plan for Wall Street. This morning, Secretary of Treasury Hank Paulson, along with the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, will be testifying on Capitol Hill asking for that money. Meanwhile, in India, policymakers have taken an unprecedented step in criminal law by sentencing a woman to life in prison for committing murder, and they convicted her based on her brainwaves. It's the latest in the use of science in the courtroom, and it is controversial. The science is new and some say questionable. The main question being, are the current tools to read brain activity reliable? Joan Allaire, our Takeaway science contributor and editor-at-large for Seed magazine, joins us now to explain this case. Good morning, Jonah.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, how does this work?
No one quite knows because this method has never been published in a peer-reviewed paper or presented at a scientific conference. No one quite knows how it works. The basic facts of the case are rather straightforward. A 24-year-old woman was convicted of killing her ex-husband in a McDonald's with arsenic. And the way the test is supposed to work is that you sit there in a room, in a very quiet room, with 32 electrodes placed in your scalp, and the facts of the case are read aloud to you. So the facts will be, you were in a McDonald's and you put arsenic in the Big Mac. And right after that, more generic facts are read, such as the sky is blue or Big Facts taste delicious, Big Macs taste delicious. And what the test is designed to do is detect the differences emitted by the brain when you hear memories that you've actually experienced, such as I put arsenic in the Big Mac, versus more generic sentences, such as the sky is blue. And that experiential memories are supposed to emit a specific signature, which is detected by these electrodes on the scalp.
All right, so wait a second, Jonah. So your brain behaves differently if you're hearing something that you know a lot about already versus you're hearing something that either is totally generic or you know nothing about.
Not just that you know about, something that you've actually experienced.
I see.
These are experiential memories. So the crucial distinction is memories you've actually experienced versus memories you've just heard about or imagined.
So
that there seems to be a signature to something, you know, the vivid, visceral experience of actually mm-hmm. putting arsenic in a Big Mac.
Okay, so let's really back up here because it sounds preposterous, actually. Does the science exist for a neurologist or anyone else to be able to look at a brain scan and tell whether that memory or the activity that they're seeing is related to an actual memory, an imagined memory, or something else?
Again, it's tough to say because the data hasn't been published, but I think a lot of scientists would say that no, the research just isn't there yet. I think one of the big trends of neuroscience in the last 10 years or so has been kind of exposing the inherent dishonesty of memories, the way every time you remember a memory, you're actually misremembering a memory, you're changing the structure of the memory itself. So that the basic assumption of this test, which is that there's a clear line between true experience memories, objective memories, and on the other hand, memories you've just imagined or heard about, that line doesn't seem to exist. That memories in the brain are much more continuum.
And this has been this whole discussion has gone on in the U.S. for some time now as developments have been made in the way that doctors can look at the brain. Very concerning that some science that has not been found to be absolutely credible is being used to convict someone of a crime.
In India.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. I talked to Amanda Pustilnik, a fellow at Harvard Law, who's an expert on the intersection of neuroscience and law. And she said one of the crucial things going forward, she thinks it's inevitable that in the next few years we will start to see brain scans and neuroscience used in courts of law, not just in India but in America as well, but that it's crucial that the evidence is standardized, is published in peer-reviewed papers, that there's a consensus that it's reliable and accurate. Because let's face it, in America, there's a long tradition of evidence being used in courts of law that isn't necessarily completely accurate, or from fingerprints to lie detector tests.
And polygraphs. That's a polygraph story. What do you think, just scientifically, is it conceivable that we'll get to a point where using fMRIs or some kind of brain scan data that the police will be able to say, hey, pal, you know a lot more about this than you're telling me?
I think it's certainly conceivable. I think the dream of having a fail-safe lie detector test is a little unrealistic. I think there's so many different types of lies and deception. For example, you know, is simply withholding facts, that's not a lie, that's simply deception. But it's hard to imagine a specific signature involved with deception as opposed to lying. So I think we may get tests that prove to be reliable in the future that can allow people to distinguish between experiential memory or other types of memory, or allow us to distinguish between blatant lies and telling the truth. But I think it's, you know, I think it's pretty unrealistic to expect science to have some magic bullet.
And just to be clear, this case in India, we're not talking about an fMRI, but we're talking about something called a brain electrical oscillations signature.
Absolutely. This is EEG. And so this is a, you know, 30-year-old technology. It's not a newfangled thing. But I think one of the things to worry about is that when fMRIs or even EEGs are presented in a court of law, they exude high-tech science. They seem so impressive, so fancy. And it's, I think it's very tough for juries to really know what's real and what's not.
Jonah, we're going to ask you to stick around a bit because we like you. Jonah Lehrer, takeaway science contributor and editor-at-large for Seed Magazine. So the science is really not there. Exactly.
Can you imagine? I mean, the woman said, I didn't do it, but the machine said you did.
Right.
I mean, she didn't even confess, I don't think.
I guess it's just disturbing because there's just no clarity on the scientific level as to whether or not there's accuracy in reading those scans. Yeah. Anyhow, we're going to move on to some headlines. Femi OK has them. She's just joined us. Femi.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke will begin testifying before the Senate Banking Committee just a few minutes from now. They're expected to urge lawmakers to hurry up and pass the $700 billion bailout plan. President Bush says he's confident Congress will pass the plan. He made some public comments today during a breakfast with Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is also before the Senate today. He's expected to say that more troops are needed in Afghanistan. And in Afghanistan, relatives of some prisoners held at Bagram Air Base are being allowed to visit for the first time. The Red Cross have been pushing for years for the face-to-face visits. In the wake of the recent fatal train crash near LA, Congress is rushing to pass legislation to limit the hours engineers can work. It would be the rail industry's first major reform in 14 years. And finally, fans who can't get enough of celebrities and want to be up close on Oscar night can enter a draw for a seat in the bleachers outside the Kodak Theatre in LA. Applications are being taken today at oscars.org. Only 300 seats are available, but last year 20,000 fans applied. If you're keen, you have until Sunday to click on that website.
Wow, 20,000. Oscars.org. Thanks, fam.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the role of fertility treatments in helping women have multiple births to accommodate their careers and lifestyles. Is it responsible? Is it ethical? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. The markets have just opened, and so far the S&P slightly up, Dow slightly up, and NASDAQ slightly up. Today, a big day on Capitol Hill where the Treasury Secretary is going to be asking the lawmakers for $700 billion, a $700 billion bailout for Wall Street. Tell us, why would you deserve a bailout?
This is Jillian. I'm calling from New York. Well, all my friends were doing it, and I guess I really didn't think about long-term consequences. It didn't really seem that risky anyways, but can I borrow $700 billion?
Sure, why not?
We'd like to hear your pitch. What does it sound like when you're asking for $700 billion, which is exactly what Secretary Paulson is going to be doing shortly on Capitol Hill? Give us your pitch, 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
She didn't leave her address. That's too bad. Still Willis is Takeaway Science contributor and editor-at-large for Seed Magazine, Jonah Lehrer. Today, Opportunity, the little Mars rover, is about to set out on a two-year, seven-mile mission to the largest Martian crater ever investigated. It's wobbling along with some minor damage to its right front wheel and can only travel about 110 yards per day. Scientists at NASA say the rover may never even make it to its destination, but if it does, we're joined by Heidi Hamel, co-director and senior researcher at the Space Science Institute. Heidi, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
Heidi's our good friend here on The Takeaway. So,
and we're glad to have you back.
Why do we want to visit this crater, Heidi?
Well, this is a much larger crater than we've been to in the past, and what's good about that is it means it's deeper, and we can then explore into the surface of Mars deeper than we've done before. And it's not just going deeper. I mean, we're not just trying to dig a hole here. By going deeper, we're actually able to explore the past geology of Mars by letting the crater do in the digging for us.
I'm glad you didn't say the words drill down. You know, it's very overused. But really, we're using the crater as a kind of a mine to show us what the interior of Mars might look like.
That's exactly right.
How old is this crater, and how much digging is Opportunity going to have to do to get into the sort of subsurface?
Well, you know, it looks like a pretty old crater. We have images from orbiting spacecraft around Mars, and the reason it looks old is it looks pretty wiped out, like eroded. It's not fresh. So it's been around a while, but Opportunity's not going to have to do any digging at all. The crater did the digging for us. So Opportunity just is driving down the side of it, looking for exposed faces on the side where we can see different layers of the rocks.
So what's happening with Opportunity? It's wobbling along. Do scientists have a sense of how badly damaged one of its legs is?
Well, you know, I'm sure they're paying really close attention to that. You know, even if it was in perfect condition, it would still have to go really slowly because, remember, you know, we're not physically there driving it, and we can't let it get into trouble. You know, you have to know what's ahead. And so we'll be taking pictures from orbit so that we know what's in its path and then letting it negotiate that as best it can.
Well, it's amazing how – I've been to JPL, and it's amazing how physically connected the operators are to those little creatures up there and the satellites that are orbiting and giving pictures in real time as the Opportunity is down on the surface. Jonah Lehrer, you ever wanted to drive one of those rovers?
I think
it sounds like a good Pixar movie, doesn't it?
It would be just great to be part of that. I mean, all of us who work in what we call remote sensing, you know, we're trying to study things far away, we feel those connections. We're one with the object.
Well, Jonah, let me ask you that. I mean, can you be one with the object, like Opportunity? I mean, can it actually – can your brain be an extension of Opportunity if the interface is right?
Oh, of course. That's what happens every time you play a video game. I think the brain is great at putting itself in imaginary spaces.
But this isn't an imaginary. I mean, you want to go visit a crater, Jonah? You can actually do it.
Well, you're able to imagine that you are on Mars. You're able to act through the robot. You're able to put yourself in that space. And the brain is great at kind of teleporting you into a different body or, in this case, a different machine many, many, many miles away.
So, Heidi, what is the most important discovery that Opportunity is likely to bring back from this crater? We've already gotten some great information from Mars to this point.
You know, it's impossible to predict important discoveries. That's why they're discoveries. If we knew what we were going to find there, we wouldn't need to go. So we're just
right. I mean,
wait
okay,
see,
yeah,
know?
Right. But they're not going to discover a Walmart there, okay?
I don't think so, but you know they're going to be really looking at the evolution of Mars's past by probing these rocks. I mean, that's the whole point. Is we don't know. That's why we're going.
A nice place for a picnic.
Well, if you like dry places.
Heidi, where would you drive Opportunity if you had a place on Mars to take it?
Hey, I'm going with the advice of Steve Squires and those folks. They know Mars much, much better than I do. And if they say this is the right place to go, the right exciting place to go, I'm with them.
All right. Well, it's going to be 2 years till it gets there, so we'll have plenty of opportunity to, you know, talk to you as a little Opportunity hobbles over the boulders. Heidi Hamel is co-director and senior researcher at the Space Science Institute. Thanks so much for being with us, Heidi.
It's a pleasure, as always.
I love this being one with the rover idea, Jonah. That's great.
Well, you know, it's the same thing when you play some video game and you're one with the car on the TV screen.
But in this particular case, it's actually going somewhere. I guess those guys who drive those drone planes in Afghanistan, they're one with that. I actually read they're one with the plane, and they actually have PTSD sometimes because their combat operations are so real.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating.
All right. Well, Jonah, thanks so much for being with us, as always.
Thank you.
Jonah Lehrer, of course, is the author of the book Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and he's editor-at-large at Seed Magazine. Markets are open flat and waiting for the testimony of Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke. And here with all the headlines is Femi Oke.
Thank you very much, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Treasury Chief Hank Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke are just about to begin to testify before the Senate Banking Committee. They'll face some tough questions from lawmakers about the proposed $700 billion bailout plan. We're just going to go live to Senator Chris Dodd. He's speaking right now, a Democrat for Connecticut. He's from the Banking, Housing and Urban Affairs Committee Chairman. Let's listen in.
600,000 Americans have lost their jobs, while millions more have watched their paychecks shrink and their benefits wither away. Perhaps the most dangerous consequence, the one that we don't speak enough about, in my view, of this economic maelstrom, is that our collective confidence in our nation's future has been badly shaken, and that needs to be restored. Less than 6 months ago, our banking committee gathered in this very room to listen to the financial leaders of the Bush administration describe what at the time seemed an inconceivable event: the government's $30 billion intervention in the sale of Bear Stearns to J.P. Morgan.
And that is Senator Chris Dodd at the Senate Banking Committee. We were listening in to that live, and very soon Treasury Chief Hank Paulson and the Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke will begin to testify before that committee.
Senator Dodd signaling some pushback, it seems like, as he prepares his statement, delivers his statement.
I think it's going to be a long day for Bernanke and Paulson in that chair on Capitol Hill.
Also on show today, President Bush for his final address at the UN General Assembly. That will take place just about an hour from now. And the financial markets appear somewhat steadier today as Wall Street opens flat. Gold prices have retreated from yesterday's high, and oil prices have fallen to nearly $108 a barrel.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. $700 billion hearings on Capitol Hill have begun, where Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is speaking before a House, a Senate committee, and also Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. And I'm sure you could do a lot with that money, too.
You know, early this morning, it seemed kind of outlandish, the idea that you would just bold-facedly stare into the camera or stare into the microphone and ask for $700 billion. But you know what? It's not outlandish at all.
This is Claudia from Amerenik. Oh, Daddy, I need a brand new car, champagne, caviar. Oh, Daddy, I need $700 billion. That's all.
That's what we asked you to do.
Right, we asked you for your pitch for $700 billion. And we all had some singing, but what about giving the money to a smarty?
Good morning. This is Troy from North Dakota, and I need $700 billion right now because just this last weekend, I took a free IQ test on Facebook, and I scored a 152. That's genius level. Einstein himself was only like a 160. That's only 8 points higher than me. And I need this cash quick and clean. I'm dealing with some serious regret here. All my life, I've been spending all my time just earning my paychecks. If I had known I'm a genius, I would have gotten to work on big problems like curing cancer or solving a global financial crisis or finding a way for the Cubs to win a series. You know, stuff that really matters.
I mean, we love Troy, but it's not working for me. So can we get interest on our $700
billion? I can pay it back over a period of, let's say, 2,000 years, and I'll give you $1,000 a minute. Now, that should cover the principal. As far as the VIG, we'll have to talk about that.
The VIG, you know, that's the mob word for interest, the VIG.
I didn't know that, yeah. but now I did. And some of the pitches were, well, they were just so selfless because they were for the children.
Hi, this is Rena from Manhattan. I'd love $700 billion to help fix the education system in New York City, in this country. $700 billion would help a lot. Thanks.
That's a good pitch. What about your own children?
My name's George Shepherd, calling from Westchester. Diapers are expensive, and so is formula. And by the time my two girls go to college, it's going to cost $700 trillion.
Well, there you go. College educations
right.
Are how about film projects?
Had to be one of those.
It's Reese from the Bronx. I've got this film project I'm working on. It's gone a little bit over budget. We're probably going to need a loan of like $720 billion, 20 extra billion just for the director, myself.
Is that James Cameron? Flattery actually gets you everywhere in this venture.
Good morning. This is Jim from Westchester. John, you're an intelligent, articulate, well-rounded individual. And I think, you know, with your experience, you understand that it would be grossly, grossly unpatriotic if you didn't supply the $700,000. Dare I say communistic?
Only $700K.
Yeah, he's asking for a bargain.
Such
and
a deal.
But I'd like an investment, I think. Should we give money to this one?
David Bogoyan here at the University of Newton Square, Worcester, Mass. I need $700 billion. I got a great idea. I'll tell you about it later. I'll kick back $100 million to you, pay you interest, and your kids will have a great life after you're gone. Give me a call back. Thanks a lot.
Sounds good to me.
He's going to tell you about the idea later, after you give him the money.
Just a little cash. One more?
Harry from Bergen County. I forgot to go to the ATM this morning. Do you think you have $700 billion you can lend me just until... I don't know, a year from now?
Sure, sure. And one more?
This is a stick-up. I want $700 billion as soon as possible. Thank you.
No more calls. We have a winner.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 23rd, and Femi Oke has just joined us, and she's got some headlines. Femi?
Thank you very much, Adora. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush will give his final address to the UN General Assembly just under an hour from now. He's expected to reassure world leaders about the U.S. financial crisis. Treasury Chief Hank Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke are testifying before the Senate Banking Committee this morning. Christopher Dodd, who is on that committee, says that the financial meltdown is a result, I quote here, of private greed and public regulatory neglect, end of quote. In Western Finland, a male student shot and killed 9 people at a vocational school today before shooting and injuring himself. In Afghanistan, relatives of prisoners held at Bagram Air Force Base are being allowed to visit detainees for the first time. The Red Cross pushed for visits. They say that face-to-face visits are required by international humanitarian law. Government auditors says that it will cost more than $3 billion to install new radiation detection equipment in all of the nation's ports. That's about $1 billion more than the Bush administration had planned to spend. On the campaign trail, I've just been looking at the candidates' schedules. It makes for some interesting reading today. John McCain, 10:30 this morning. He will be in Strongsville, Ohio, with a speech. Then at 11:20, he tours the Nova Machines products in Middleburg, Ohio. And then at 4 p.m., Dow Corning Corporation in Freeland, Michigan. Sarah Palin, 12 p.m., meets with Afghan President Karzai. In New York, 1 p.m. meets with the Colombian President Uribe in New York City. 2:15, all Eastern time, by the way. She meets with Dr. Henry Kissinger in New York City. And Joe Biden has appointment today, and that's at 5 p.m. when he will address the National Jewish Democratic Council Conference in Washington, D.C. Senator Obama is nowhere to be seen on any of the lists for publicized schedules for the campaign trail, and it is believed that he is preparing for the presidential debate on Friday. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thanks very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
Also in the news today, the oil markets, which continue to prove to be quite volatile. Yesterday, investors reacted to the $700 billion proposed bailout of Wall Street by sending crude oil prices up $25 before things settled back down again. Finished the day with a gain of $16.37 to close at $120.92. Meanwhile, the dollar dropped and the Dow faced a steep decline of 373 points. It's open this morning and things began flat on the markets, but the oil prices dipped this morning. They were trading around $108 per barrel. So what's going on? Peter McKay from the Wall Street Journal has been taking a look. Peter, what are we to make of this latest volatility in the oil markets?
It's partially a fundamental kind of supply and demand story, but it's also partially, kind of Wall Street traders doing things to game one another that may not necessarily concern, say, the listener at home. You had expiration of some contracts for October delivery yesterday. So
you want to explain that for us?
Yes. Yeah. The way that the market trades, in Lower Manhattan is that they're not trading oil. They're not trading physical oil. They're trading contracts for delivery, known as futures. And those contracts are used by industrial users of oil, but they're also used by speculators who are trading oil purely as a financial bet. So when the contracts expire, they have to unwind their bet so that they don't actually, they're not on the hook to make or take delivery of physical oil. So that's the process that we went through yesterday. It always adds volatility, but under the current circumstances, with everything else going on in the financial markets, obviously it just really went nuts.
And yeah, I love that idea that if they don't unwind their position, they actually, someone's going to bring them like a giant tanker of oil to their house and put it on their doorstep.
It has been known to happen. It happens with other commodities too, like wheat and pork bellies and stuff like that. It's not pretty.
That's so annoying when that happens. I know. How do you get rid of those pork bellies? But the interesting thing here is that what we're seeing is when the market tanks or when the dollar tanks, that there's a lot of money that's looking for some sort of safe haven. We've seen that with gold.
Right.
Oil will suddenly, even for a period of hours, be that safe haven.
Right.
What does that do to the pit? I mean, yesterday it just was so hysterical down there in the pit looking at that upward move.
Right. Yeah, and the reason why it has kind of taken on this safe haven aspect characteristic is that it's tangible stuff. If you just think in the simplest terms, a lot of the things we've seen over the last week or so are undermining confidence in paper investments. If you own a share of stock, it's basically a piece of paper. Same thing with a bond or whatever. So ultimately, you have to put some sort of faith in the issuer. And right now, faith is just low in all sorts of paper investments right now. So people go into oil, they go into gold. Other commodities are rallying as well.
Peter, a very quick last question because we just have about 10 seconds. What should we be looking for as negotiations on Capitol Hill move forward? What should we should be looking for on the markets?
I think the markets will continue to be volatile, and there's still a lot of details to be worked out.
Peter McKay, thanks very much.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Peter McKay is a Wall Street Journal reporter. Now we're going to head to Capitol Hill to find out what's happening there. And our pal, Todd Zwillick from the Capitol Connections. How are you, Todd?
Hey, good morning. I'm all right. How are you?
So what's happening now? There were late night meetings, members of the leadership there on Capitol Hill, among others, the officials from the Bush administration. Are they any closer now to some kind of timeline on this $700 billion bailout?
They're closer. They're definitely closer. They're not there yet. That's the message you get over and over, especially from Barney Frank, the chairman of the Financial Services Committee in the House. He is he's Mr. Point Man on this. There's no question about it. So he spent a lot of time briefing the press yesterday and going in and out of meetings. So the dynamics that you have now basically are House Democrats negotiating with Senate Democrats for the most part, probably consulting with Republicans, but not necessarily negotiating with them. And then everything that they work out has to be bounced off the administration, obviously, because it's their plan, and also they have to be the ones to sign it. So, yes, they're closer. There are some outstanding points that they haven't worked out yet. One is this issue of executive pay. The Democrats are very interested as I'm sure you know, of having companies that sign up for any portion of this $700 billion bailout, they want them to make sure that their executives are then locked in to not having exorbitant pay or what's affectionately called a golden parachute. As long as taxpayers on the, are on the hook, Democrats don't want CEOs, you know, having a great deal. They're having a little trouble on that one with the administration. The administration is not terribly interested. Not terribly interested in that.
Right. Isn't it curious though, that a lot of prominent Republicans are walking away from this, saying it's like a violating sort of constitutional advice and consent sort of questions, and a lot of the Democrats seem to be negotiating on some of the hard deals and getting closer to the administration?
Well, it's true, John. I think it's interesting on so many levels. Republicans have nothing really to gain here. That's not a partisan statement. If you look at what's happened, a lot of what Treasury wants, what the White House wants, goes against core Republican principles. It's a gigantic government intervention. It's some kind of violation of free market imperatives. And there are a lot of conservative Republicans who are not interested. That's true. Now, you say walk away. We'll see how many walk away. There's a lot of people who are complaining that the principles are being violated. But this is an emergency, and when people's backs are against the wall, I talked to one Republican in the Senate yesterday who's very, very unhappy with the whole thing. And in the Senate, one senator can slow things down a lot. He can't kill it, but he can slow it way down. And he was saying all kinds of terrible things about the program and socialism. And I said, Are you gonna slow it down? He said, well, I'm probably not going to be the guy to stand in front of the freight train, not unless I have somebody with me. So,
and that certainly will unfold today. But very quickly, Secretary of Treasury Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke are on the Hill today to testify. What's your sense? Is there anxiety revolving around that very quickly?
I think it's going to be important for them to steady the troops and tell them to get this done quickly. And by the way, he's not the only one coming up. Those conservatives and the Republicans need a pep talk. Vice President is coming up this morning to give Republicans a little talking to.
All right. Todd Zwillick, Capital News Connection, coming to us from Washington, D.C. Thank you.
The senators are still talking on Capitol Hill, and so far the markets are reacting positively. There's lots of ways to catch up with us at The Takeaway, Twitter, Friend Feed, Facebook. We're talking about oil markets and everything else.
We're also talking about that $700 billion bailout. It's time to make your case. Give us your pitch, thetakeaway.org or 8778-MY-TAKE.
And here's your takeaway for today.
People who've been saying repeatedly this crisis is contained are now saying, give us $700 billion or, you know, the apocalypse happens tomorrow.
That pretty much covers it. That's New York Times reporter Peter Goodman.
And we're going to be watching what happens on Capitol Hill today. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.